Evening and good evening to you in Zoom land. And it's wonderful to be here and practice with living, breathing beings and with all of you out there on Zoom. Really thinking about what I wanted to talk about tonight, and I was actually picking up some dogen, and then I got really stressed out over the war in Ukraine again, and it just makes me incredibly sad, having grown up in Germany. Ukraine seems to be really close to home, and my neighbor is actually a Russian family. My neighbors are a wonderful family with two young kids, and my nephew married a girl, a woman, who is from Moscow and whose mother is actually pretty high party functionary. And so it's all close, it feels really close to home. And all the images we see on TV and the news, it just breaks my heart to see these people, you know, who just want to go about their life, who want to just do what they do, and then go home and go to sleep. They can't. The sound of weapons being fired and landing in your neighborhood. People are so used to it, habituated to it. A lot of them don't even go to shelters anymore. It's just like, and all this is deeply distressing to me. And the big question is, how do we practice in the middle of the hellfire? How can we relate to this human disaster without burning out, without making ourselves numb, without getting so upset that it ruins our life, because that doesn't really help anybody either? How do we witness? How do we bear witness? How do we remember all this? And I don't have a whole lot of answers. I actually don't have any answers other than being present with it, feeling what I feel, crying without being ashamed or embarrassed, to feel the sadness that comes with it, and experience joy when I experience it. The sun was out today. It's getting warmer. Spring is coming after all this time. I went shopping today and hardly anybody was wearing masks. I was the exception. And well, about 80%+ of the people were not wearing masks, and that's fine. And they tell me that Omicron, the latest Omicron variant, is so contagious that my mask really doesn't help a whole lot. So we'll see how it all works out, because, you know, everything somehow does work out in the end. those of you who have been around me for a while know that I have been really engaged in bodhisattva practice this year, and that I was reading and studying again about bodhisattvas. And Avalokiteshvara's compassion and Manjushri's wisdom come together as Samantabhadra's enlightening activity. And so I thought I would speak about my old friend Samantabhadra a little bit, because he does express himself acting in this world, helping beings. So I found this poem. And it's Hongqi's poems on the Bodhisattvas from the Complete Enlightenment Sutra. The livelihood of my house is nature's source. In all lands, countless as dusts, Samantabhadra is seen. A rhinoceros horn has a single point. A toad's shadow is transparent. The spirit jewel has nine facets. A line of ants is penetrating. Awakening has no gradual stages and erases embroidered edges. Illusions naturally melt away and blend into the circle. The wondrous response pervades the body without front or back. The ancient flower mirror is not stained by dazzling beauty. So, I really appreciate giving a Dharma talk here, and I thank you for listening. And I also thank Tim and Norman and Kiku Christina Lanehur, who was Abbotess Hasahara the first time I was there. They all have led me to Samantabhadra being my patron bodhisattva. And especially Christina Lanehur had a beautiful Samantabhadra statue in her cabin where she used to do tokusan. And she always said before she started a Dharma talk, that we should consider the teaching as tentative. And I would really invite you to go forward with a little bit less certainty that we know how things actually are. And Dogen wrote in Genjo Koan that we can only practice as far as our eye of practice can reach at any given point. So I don't know if that ever happened to you. You chant something often, and after maybe years, all of a sudden a line jumps out at you and grabs you and says, yeah, this is what I mean. And even that is tentative. So if I say something that does not land with you, the fault, the misunderstanding is all mine. And if you can relate to this world with your Zen attitude, the credit should if I say something of value to that, the credit should go to my teachers. So, but now back to Samandabhadra. I've been investigating this bodhisattva a lot. And at different times, I've had different insights. And they are sometimes somewhat contradictory. We are radically alone. We go into our mind, we're there, nobody else. And we are absolutely interconnected with each and every being, with this planet, with the sun, with the rain that falls. We all carry a piece of Samandabhadra in us, along with Avalokiteshvara, with Manjushri. We are all wise. We are all compassionate. We all act as bodhisattvas, as enlightening beings. And sometimes we're also kind of silly. We are saying the wrong thing. We are rude without meaning to. We're just humans. Our enlightening activity comes from the same place or lives at the same place as our zazen. Sometimes I fall into old patterns and I'm not authentic. Samandabhadra, being in the background of my mind, reminds me that my desire to look good and be accepted is not as important as being authentic. That wanting to look good is a big trap. And Samandabhadra also reminds me to be unreasonable more often, to not believe in my limitations as much as I usually do. So what does it look like in real life? That's where it gets complicated, doesn't it? When I was learning to be a mindfulness teacher, there was this mantra repeated by almost every instructor, which was, no fixing, no saving, no setting anybody straight. And often when when I engage in a new project, especially when it's near and dear to my heart, you know, I try to fix everything that is connected with it. We want to save the world. I need to pay great attention at this point because I have noticed my own habitual patterns around these things. When Chris is on autopilot, my conditioning just fully kicks in before, unless I become aware of it. So it's often our strong suit that something that worked for us at some time in the past. And so for me, the default pattern is when I have a sense of urgency, I get fixated on an outcome, which is really horrible. When I become self-aware, I shut that down and I say, I'm going to do my best, and then we'll just see what happens. Because outcomes are just not guaranteed. And being fixated on an outcome also doesn't allow me to see the full picture of what is happening around me, because my focus really narrows. It becomes like a telephoto lens that just grabs one thing with great clarity and just dismisses everything else. And then I work harder usually. When the project or whatever I'm engaged in is not happening according to my desires, I go back to step one. The sense of urgency gets greater, I fixate even more on outcome, and so on. So this does not work very well. It leaves me and the people around me frustrated. If I become aware of my autopilot response, I can step back, become aware of my body, become aware of what is going on in my mind, become aware of the people I'm engaging with. My focus widens from telephoto to landscape. So, some years ago, I stumbled across this little book. It's called Trying to Be Human by Sherry Huber. And she has this excellent, it's from a Dharma talk, this excellent short story talk, A Project for Saving the World. Sherry Huber writes, "In considering the problems that exist in this world, we somehow maintain the delusion that hatred is helpful. I hate pollution, so the whole time I'm driving my car, I hate the traffic and hating the exhaust fumes and feeling, why doesn't the Environmental Protection Agency do something about this? Of course, I've got to drive. I lead a busy life. So she goes into greater detail how she gets angry about things. And then she switches mode. She switches from dealing with a problem on a mundane level into how her idea functions if she was to create a project for saving the world. Let's imagine we are a group of people who decide they are going to save the world. Not because we should, not even because we believe there is anything wrong with the world, but simply because we want to. Now, in taking this on as our project, there are a couple of rules we will adopt. One, we cannot blame anybody else. And two, we cannot involve anybody else. In other words, we have to take complete responsibility. And a little bit later, she writes, remember that we are engaged in this project only because we want to, not because we are angry, and not because we think there is something wrong that we can correct. Because the world is exactly as it is. There may be aspects, there may be people we don't like, but still, this is the world as it is. So, one thought is this reality? As soon as we say the world should not be the way it is, as soon as we start arguing with reality, we've kind of set ourselves up for having lost this battle. The world is as it is, and this is how we need to interact with it. It doesn't mean that maybe we don't have a great desire to change something. And this is where I think Sherry Huber expressed great words of wisdom. Let's help because we want to help. Let's do things because we want to. And maybe we can skip the self-sabotage of living in this illusory world of shoulds, and it should be this way and it has to be this way. I know that her writing seems to be radical because she doesn't talk about fixing and things being wrong. She just talks about wanting to go forward because it's the right thing to do. That way of engaging with the world requests something radical of us, because usually we have something, a problem or something we want to tangle with, and our thinking comes from my thinking often comes from a feeling of lack, something missing. And from that position, I cannot be useful to the world, to the people around me. So it requires something beyond change, because change is just we take something, we tweak it, we modify it a little bit and shape it different, but it's still basically the same thing, just changed. But when I'm asking of my practice, what I'm inviting is transformation. It is coming from a place of willingness and abundance and not anger and lack. So if I can meet this transformation, if I can meet the conditions in the world, if I can bear witness with that attitude, that is what my transformation looks like. Transforming activity, transforming myself. So one thing I tend to do at times is I write my own gathas, little verse that I may stick somewhere, usually on my nightstand, so it's like the first and last thing that I see before falling asleep and when waking up. And there's actually two things. There's sometimes a gatha, and there's always a permanent one that says gratitude, and it reminds me when I wake up and open my eyes to be grateful for something, to someone. And there's some wonderful examples of gathas in the Avatamsaka Sutra. Just opened the random page and picked out some. And the language is a little bit different than what we usually use for gathas. We usually say, may I and all beings do this and serve the world by doing it. The language is a little bit different, but I didn't want to change it. When washing the face with water, they should wish that all beings attain the pure teaching and be forever free from defilement. Taking up a bowl, we should wish that all beings perfect the vessel of truth and receive human and divine support. Setting out on a road, they should wish that all beings go where the Buddha goes, into the realm of non-reliance. When on the road, they should wish that all beings tread the pure realm of reality, their minds without obstruction. May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.